speaker today is Doc Searles. Doc is a...
Hey.
Give him a clap. Doc is a veteran of this industry. Up through the 80s and 90s, ran marketing communication for a bunch of IT firms. Ended up having his own. The big breakthrough for not just Doc, but a lot of the rest of us, came in a book which was first published as a series of essays on the net back in 1999 called The Clue Train Manifesto. Hey, yeah, it worked. We had one of Doc's co-writers, co-authors here a couple of years ago, Chris Locke, a.k.a. Rage Boy. Doc is of a different nature. The themes, the topics communicated in the Clue Train Manifesto, most importantly the meme, Markets Are Conversations, which I believe was Rage Boy's, has been a pillar underbearing a lot of what's been happening for the last 6 years. I think that Thomas can agree that a lot of what he has tried to bring forward in Reboot are really learnings from Clue Train Manifesto. The time in between 1999 and now 2005 has been spent in a lot of different ways. I'm not going to repeat the history, but a lot of the values which were written in that book are finally starting to be realized throughout the value chain, not just in some grassroots movement, not just some crazy blogger, not just some adolescent writing on LiveJournal, but all the way up through the corporate structure, all the way horizontally in the media structure. And our hope is that today that Doc can clue us in a little bit more on what has been happening and what is happening, and revisit these notions. So, Doc, please.
Is it on? Yeah. I feel like a magician walking out on stage with a box of stuff. Here. There we go. You're mistaking me for Ben Hammersley. Hang on. There we go. Ta-da. Let's see if this actually works. It may be magic. There we go. Ta-da. All right. One small correction to what Nikolai said. Of the 95 theses of the Clue Train Manifesto, the only one that was entirely mine was Markets or Conversations. All the rage was Chris's, and all the fine articulation was David Weinberger's. He's going to be here tomorrow. He couldn't make it today, but he'll be here tomorrow. The theme for this thing has to do with language. I've only been here for a short time, but I've spoken to cab drivers. I hung out with some of you guys last night, and I hung out at the airport for a while, and I watched some TV last night, and I'm really glad to find that the Danish people are, in fact, preserving Danish as a second language. So it's very easy for me. I made up that joke before we tried to get on the metro this morning, and it took a committee of English speakers to figure out the machine that dispenses the thing. So it wasn't quite accurate. Oh, I actually have a thing I can control this with and walk around. Okay. So, all right. So an interesting thing for me is that we're already rebooting our vocabularies, whether we know it or not, or whether we like it or not. A case in point is the word like. Those of you who speak English can actually speak much less of it now thanks to the word like, because like has managed to replace a lot of other things. Like is to California what fucking is to New York. I love a conference where I can say fuck. I just, it's great. I grew up in New Jersey, which is which is the fucking state or the fucking garden state, where they have the fucking vocabulary, which is fucking A, fucking B, fucking C, when you're not saying yo. The interesting thing is it's also to Hugh MacLeod. I couldn't find one of his jokes that has fuck in it, but he says fuck as much as he can. Anyway, to talk in New York, correctly pronounced New York, you have to know the fucking insertion principle, which is you can insert fucking between 82 syllables. So, for example, you can in fucking insert fucking be fucking between 82 syllable fucking bulls, right? That's how it works. But unlike fucking, like actually causes mental retardation. That's a fact, because like is like a virus for adverbs or like any other speech parts. So it's like an Andromeda strain or a body snatcher for speech. It applies to any or all of them. We use very or really or carefully or whatever. Whatever is another California word. It's like dude, like whatever, you know. When like does the same job. So if words are the tools of the mind and like empties adverbs and whatever out of the toolbox, you've got like a lot fucking less to work with, right? I discovered this actually when I was about 20 years ago or 15 years ago, when my son, who's a really bright guy, and his really bright friends, this is in Palo Alto, California. They don't even let you in unless you're bright. It's like they don't let you come in this country unless you look really good. I noticed that one too. But anyway, they don't let you leave, maybe. I don't know what the deal is. But anyway, he and his friends were sitting in the back, and they were having this conversation and went like, dude, you know, he was all like, and whatever. And I said, guys, man, you know, by doing this exercise in vocabulary subtraction, you're actually teaching yourself mental retardation. And one of the kids said, dude, that's rad. Like, so they turned out all right, though. Guys, just, you know, so it's not all bad, because it also replaces and as Strunk and White said, write with nouns and verbs, not with adjectives and adverbs. A lot of us who are in the writing profession learned a lot from Strunk and White, which is a nice little book that teaches you how to write nice, concise language. So they wrote, the adjective hasn't been built that can pull a weaker and inaccurate noun out of a tight place. And also, it's nouns and verbs, not their assistance to give good writing its toughness and color. And also, like has nothing on content. So that's where I'm really going. It's like, it has nothing on content as a cause of mental retardation, especially in our business, which is technology, more or less. Because like kills the noun's assistance, but content actually kills real nouns, actual real nouns. So newspapers and magazines usually have writing and photography and other forms of what we called editorial. That was sort of our general term for those things. Broadcasters, actually, also used to be, had something called programming, and now they all have content, right? Some of those used to be writers and photographers and graphic artists, and that was including me. I mean, I thought of myself as a writer, and all of a sudden I'm told I'm a content provider, right? So somewhere we became sources. That was other. He's a source of content. You know, we'll hire him as a source of content. John Perry Barlow, who's a very vivid writer and a lyricist for the Grateful Dead, among other things, once just dropped this line, which is, I didn't start hearing about content until the container business started going away. But, of course, the container business is still around. So we've got to do some thinking here. And so, for example, I think we need to think about, like, why every fucking thing on the earth needs a goddamn business model. So this is a little bugaboo of mine. This is an idea for a Hugh cartoon. You know, what's your fucking business model? Does my fucking need one? Anyway, here's a question. So so use it, Hugh, however you want there. Okay, so why do we think we need to monetize blogs and podcasts? Get asked this, how do you make money blogging, right? And, you know, because the net's this new world where you can do damn near anything, and it naturally follows that you can go into business doing anything. This is what made the whole .com thing happen. Look, we could do anything with the net. Therefore, we can make money doing anything. It didn't follow, but it followed anyway. So even if the .com crashed, everybody kept chanting this mantra taught by VCs, which is, what's your business model, right? So does everything need a fucking business model? So what's the business model, say, for your driveway or your phone or your pants or your floorboards or your toothbrush? I think these things are best understood as useful expenses, right? So they may be... That may also be true of many and maybe even most online media, this thing we call media. So, which brings us to a deeper language problem, which is what I'd like to frame what we may be talking about over the next several days. I think it's unfortunate that the net looks, or worse actually is, like a big transport system, because And I think this is a problem, because then it carries all previous media, print and audio and video and so forth. And we think everything's content for delivery to users or consumers, then we think we can make money with it just like we did with all this old media. We think we get away with it. And we miss some simple facts, such as thanks to the net, most of us have more fun and find out more and contribute more and know more and actually make more money because of blogging or podcasting or whatever than with any of those things. There's this story we think, well, we have to make money with something. Well, we can actually make money because of something. So the VC's question is actually a right one, but it may not be about the thing that you think you need to make money doing. So here's a suggestion. Online publishing may work better as an expense than as a business. And the case in point is the New York Times. I actually got to witness the New York Times doing something really big and stupid last week, or the week before, when I was at the Syndicate conference in New York. And this is not... No, it is a knock on the New York Times. Who would say it? Anyway, so I think they suffer from what I'll call contentivitis, which is noun replacement disease. That's when you use content to replace all these other things. Else, why would it do something as dumb as this? Okay, this is an announcement where they said, we're going to take everything that we're now... Anybody here ever look for an article in the New York Times, an old article, or in any magazine or newspaper, and all of a sudden you get hit with a paywall that wants you to pay $2.95 for something that was written 10 years ago, right? Well, another thing that happens at the same time is because they hide all that content, Google can't find it, and all of a sudden, you know, bloggers have more reputation than the New York Times because Google finds bloggers and it doesn't find the New York Times. So they decided that they're not going to change that, they're just going to change the pricing model to $49.95 for everything. So that's what they did. So it causes some screwy thinking. So here's the press release that they put out, and here's Martin Niesenholz, who's a really good guy of the New York Times, of the online side of the New York Times, at the Syndicate conference in New York, explaining what frankly, was a kind of a stupid thing. And so he said, among other things, that the entire history of all of the archives of the New York Times were this great treasure, and he used this term. It's a treasure trove. It's an enormous treasure trove. But I'm thinking, $49.95. They're going to charge $49.95 for the entire treasure trove. They used to charge $2.95 for... It didn't quite make sense. So, and he then said that, in fact, right now they're making about $1 million a year selling old content, which I don't know what the whole company makes, $500 million or something like that. It's a small amount. And I was thinking, well, what does $1 million buy? Well, it buys a house that looks like this in Santa Barbara, where I live. That's it. I looked that up. That's $1 million house in Santa Barbara. So that's what the New York Times is making doing this, and it doesn't make any sense. So how do we, and there's several slides I used to insult the Times that I cut out of here, so I won't stay on it. So how do we get our heads around this language problem? And I think we could do it by taking Cognitive Linguistics 101, which I'm about to give you, which is... This is a kind of a red pill thing. Have we all seen The Matrix? Okay, all right. I'm talking about The Matrix here, actually. So there really is a matrix that tells us what to think and say. And that matrix is the set of concepts that we use to make sense of the world. And we're not really conscious of what those concepts are, but they do most of our thinking and talking for us. So that's metaphors. The real matrix is metaphors. And the guy who discovered this, pretty much, is George Lakoff, who is a professor at UC Berkeley in California. And he makes this point. We think and talk about everything in terms of other things. So we borrow whole vocabularies, like unconsciously. So like, I said like, oh my God, I'm from California. Anyway, so every metaphor is kind of a box of words. That's what they are. And that box of words is this concept. So concepts actually frame our understanding. So for example, we can take time and we can take life. And that's the closest thing I could come to demonstrating what life is. So we actually think and talk about time in terms of something else. Can anybody here tell me what that is? Money, very good. You win the time. Very good. Anyway, yeah, time is money. So we save it, we waste it, we spend it, we lose it, we throw it away, we set it aside, we invest it. It's entirely an unconscious thing. How about life? What do we think about life in terms of? See, it's unconscious. We can all not think of it at the same time, even though we use it, which is, it's travel. When we say birth is arrival or death is departure, choices are crossroads, or careers are paths, or we get stuck in a rut, or we fall off the wagon, or we go in the passing lane, or we get run over by somebody else, all of those things, conceive life in terms of travel. There isn't anything like it. I'm living, I'm not traveling anywhere right now, but it doesn't matter. We think of it in terms of something else. So this is the most all-purpose one. As a journalist, I know I can bring in war as a box of words to describe anything there is. That's just the way we tend to work. So, in fact, George S. Patton said, compared to war, all other forms of human endeavor shrink to insignificance. So, in fact, we can't avoid using them anywhere. So, for example, at Les Blogs, which was in a show, really good show in Paris a few weeks ago, I took that picture, you know, traditional media strikes back, right? It's a war metaphor. Can't help using it. So what do we understand the net in terms of? Okay, so here's a case in point. Let's say you were to look up, if you're in the U.S., we have this thing called the Federal Communications Commission, the FCC. And we look up the term, say, FCC indecency. You look up that thing there, and you're going to get a page that looks like this. And right up there, there's the word FCC indecency, and we come up with a page. There, it's that's the parents' place, obscene and indecent broadcasts. Okay, and you'll notice that the URL says has the word content in there. Okay, not coincidental. And there's this thing, obscenity, profanity, indecency. It's against the law, right? And obscene, and especially important is down here where it says, let's see, yep, there we go. Obscene speech is not protected by the First Amendment of the U.S. Constitution. That's the First Amendment. It's like the most important one in many ways, which is free speech. And it's not protected. Well, why is that? You know, how can you reconcile the First Amendment with the FCC? I mean, here's the First Amendment, and then there's this thing of the FCC. Obscenity and indecency are all completely prohibited, and you're not allowed to do that. And they're suing guys off the air. They're making the penalties really steep. So if you say this one thing, how can you then say this other thing? It doesn't agree, and it's been held up by courts of law for the last 7 years. Well, the reason is you could define broadcasting as transporting content, not as speech, right? So you're moving these goods. So free speech actually happens in a place, whereas content gets transported through something. So the difference isn't trivial. The difference is, in fact, critical. So as we see from the FCC, this content not protected. So when we talk about content, we're talking about something that really is different than free speech and the exercise of free speech. So that's not protected. The non-press media are not protected. Again, I'm talking about the U.S. here, but I'm sure it's not a whole lot different in Europe and other places. The press is still safe for now, but what about the press on the net? Okay. So there's actually a fight going on right now between four different metaphors that we use to describe the net. So I've been watching this for the last few years. If we say we move content through a medium with a transport protocol, we're talking about shipping. We're saying the net is a shipping system. When we architect or design or construct or build these things called sites with addresses and locations that have traffic, or we talk, you know, then we're actually talking about real estate. We're talking about it as a place. If we talk about the information highway, actually, we're kind of mixing those two. When we write or author these things called pages, and have files that have writing in them and that we browse on the net, we're talking about it as writing. We're talking about the net we're doing there as writing. And the fourth is that when we say we're performing for an audience and we want to give them an experience, then we're talking about theater. And we can mix that with the first one when we say that I want to deliver an experience to you, right? So here's an interesting thing. Which one is best for democracy, especially personal democracy, which is another conference I was just at, and that's the reason I have this slide. It's with these two. There are these two. The net's a place, free speech, though writing through writing and equally protected forms. There's nothing wrong with the other metaphors. We can't help using them as well. And we need to stand on and for the net is a place where free speech happens. It's not by accident, I don't think, that Larry Lessig and his associates created something called the Creative Commons. The Commons is a location. It recasts the net, or it casts the net as a place where protected speech and playing of music, and for that matter, markets happen, right? So, and it's where free enterprise happens. That satisfies the conservatives, because they like to hear about free enterprise. So if we say speech is content for consumers in an audience, we lose. You know, in fact, that very JPEG there is called content-no. You can't have this content. I mean, that's how deeply subconscious this is with the FCC. Now, the interesting thing here is that, indeed, Hollywood wants to regulate content, right? Some churches and lobbyists want to restrict content. Lots of interests want to protect consumers in these things called audiences, which are is that other for? Because they think the net is yet another medium, right? So, but it's not. It's a place for free speech and for free markets, too. So Congress and the FCC say that we're all still consumers. They don't know that we're producers now. And this is an interesting piece of speech. This is something that Michael Powell, who's now the ex-chairman of the FCC in the U.S., gave. Now, he's known, he's remembered now, as a guy who was really pretty friendly to the net, as federal bureaucrats go. But if you look at what he said, you know, he's talking about and I boldface some of these, you know, providers, and they need a willing consumer to have access to broadband, you know, continue to expect the demand and look for have access to meaningful information. The whole thing is so asymmetrical. It assumes that you or a consumer need the right to access the stuff that's given away or sold by the big people. I mean, that's sort of what the metaphor is behind this thing. The interesting thing is that speech informs. It's not about delivering content. And the difference is critical. Information is a commodity. It's content. And it's derived from... It's an interesting thing. This is a conversation I had with Tim O'Reilly a few years. Some of you may know who he is. He's the publisher of a lot of books that programmers use. And if it go to any geek's cubicle in a corporation, then you're going to see a shelf full of O'Reilly books. And Tim and I were both talking about the discomfort that we have with this term information as a commodity. And we realized as we dug into that it's derived from the verb to inform, which is in turn derived from the verb to form, meaning we actually form each other. If one of you says something I have not heard before and I'm influenced by that and I remember it now, I'm changed by that. I'm not the same person. I'm different in some small way. And that means we actually form each other, and we're changed by that, and that actually means, in other words, we're authors of each other. This is an interesting thing, that we're actually all authors of each other. That's a big part of what it means to be human beings. And authority, which is what Google measures with PageRank, by the way, is the right we give certain other people to form and shape what we know. Google and Technorati and Feedster and PubSub and others rank results by the number and authority of inbound links. And we don't just find the best information, we find who or what is best qualified to form or author what we know. That's what's happening with that. So we don't just inform each other by delivering content. And much of what happens on the net is about sharing and improving ideas, which is how syndication happened. And I think syndication is one of the most profound things to happen in the last 20 years, if not ever, because suddenly it's given everybody the right to notify everybody else that we just said something that can change or form other people. So... Now, how new standards and practices grow in blogging and podcasting and tags, identity, and much more is significant. So anyway, so I'm getting toward the end of this, and we have a big Q&A later. So the net's this place where the demand side supplies itself. In my For Linux Journal, which Nikolai didn't mention, I actually make my money working for Linux Journal. I don't make much money blogging. I've had to make anybody money blogging. But I'm the senior editor of Linux Journal, which means I'm the oldest editor on staff, by the way. I'm almost always the oldest guy, which is kind of cool, for a while, and then after a while it gets less cool. Anyway, it's where the demand side supplies itself. This is what I know about open source. The cool thing about open source is that programmers and engineers and so forth, not liking what they were getting from vendors, supplied themselves. I think this is one of the most profound things that's happened anywhere ever in the history of humanity, and the net is the place where that's happened. So an interesting thing is no big brand company vetted blogging or Wikipedia or Technorati or Flickr, which most of them, how many people here are using Flickr right now? What, about half? That's pretty amazing. At a photo processing place near where I live in Santa Barbara in California, they have these bins where they put the processed photos. They're almost empty now. Flickr has done that. The web. If the net had been left up to the big boys, it never would have happened. And this is a Hugh cartoon that I found. It's one that I did find. And I thought that he actually used it. No vendor would allow the internet to happen. Hollywood, which is a large class of people that is led by Hollywood because they do the most heavy lobbying in the U.S., doesn't see the net that we see. Or maybe they do and they're afraid of it. And they've done their best to kill it. And so far they've done a good job of killing, for example, internet radio. Internet radio was growing really well up until about 3 years ago. A little history on that, and then we'll be done. There was something called the Digital Millennium Copyright Act that was passed in the U.S. in 1998, and there was something called the Copyright Arbitration Royalty Panel, which actually originally was a Copyright Royalty Arbitration Panel, and then they saw what it spelled. So anyway, they had rules for webcasting that finalized by the Copyright Office in 2001, and many of the best internet radio stations went immediately off the net. And no radio industry worthy of the name has since developed. Podcasting has, but podcasting worked in many ways to get around the rules that were developed by the DMCA. And it's easy to see why. Jamie Zawinski, who was the guy who named Mozilla, and he was like employee number 4 at Netscape way back when, and now runs the DNA Lounge in San Francisco, published this thing. He was interested in internet radio, and the rules came down, and he said, you know, the word is labyrinthine. And these are all of the things, if you're running an internet radio station, that you have to do. You have to do all these things. You have to, you know, in a 3-hour period, you can't repeat this. If it's archived, you can't repeat that. Language is a big part of it. They defined webcasting as performance, as like a live performance, and also as a perfect copy, a perfect digital copy. The notion of broadcasting had nothing to do with it. And it actually got worse. You had to if you do webcasting, you actually have to report all these things. It's a huge thing. Feature recording artist, retail album title. And down here, the name, the country in which the user received the transmission, a unique user identifier for every single... Things that don't exist. They essentially insisted on a technology that did not yet exist and knocked a lot of guys off the air. So we need to fight, I think, for the world that we've barely begun to make. I think it's really, really early in history of the net. I think we need to reboot some of this stuff around vocabulary and do it one frame at a time, and that's the end of it. Thank you very much. The great Robert Scopel.
Thank you, Doc. We're going to try to do a combined Q&A with... between Doc and Robert afterwards.